This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, May 23rd, 2011. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, in for Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, a massive tornado has killed dozens and damaged around 2,000 buildings in Joplin, Missouri. Spanish election results deliver a wide victory to the right wing, while protesters against the country's political system vow to remain camped out in the public plazas. And we'll take a look at how Berkeley is examining the issue of how to keep guns out of local schools. Those stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert with these headlines. There are gun battles in the streets of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, today, where witnesses report that several government buildings have been set ablaze. The violence comes after Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh refused to sign an agreement that would have him step down from office. He said he'd only sign the agreement if opposition leaders came to the presidential palace to sign in person.
If they refuse, we will face them with all available means everywhere. And if the country goes to civil war, they will have to bear the responsibility and the bloodshed that will be everywhere.
Violence in the Pakistani city of Karachi as well, where commandos regained control of a naval base today. Taliban forces attacked the high-security compound and then occupied it for 18 hours, killing 12 security officers and destroying at least two U.S.-supplied surveillance planes. Here's Taliban spokesperson Asanallah Asan, as translated by Al Jazeera's English Language Service.
We have two purposes in attacking this base. One is to harm the military, which is secular and supportive of the Americans, but unable to protect neither the land nor the people of Pakistan or Islam. Second, the incidents in Abbottabad and drone attacks have opened everybody's eyes. This attack is also the revenge for the killing of Sheikh Osama bin Laden. And even if we kill thousands of enemies, it will not be a sufficient revenge. Such operations will continue until our revenge is complete.
At least four Taliban members were killed in the fighting. In unrelated news, Taliban spokesmen are vigorously denying internet rumors that the movement's spiritual leader has died or been killed. Afghanistan's main intelligence service says cleric Mullah Omar has disappeared from his alleged hideout, but Western diplomats in the area say they're skeptical of reports he's been killed. The European Union has for the first time imposed sanctions on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The movement is a response to the Assad government's crackdown on protesters, which has reportedly killed more than 900. EU Foreign Secretary Catherine Ashton.
The government needs to understand that people are asking by peaceful protest for the kind of reforms that the government has said that they're interested in. And they now ought to try and engage properly and do that.
In Israel, the civil trial over the death of American peace activist Rachel Corrie resumed yesterday with the testimony of a former Israeli army spokesperson. A bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier crushed and killed Corrie in 2003 while she was trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home in Gaza. FSRN's Gillian Kessler-Damor has more from Jerusalem.
The search for answers in the killing of Rachel Corrie continues, over 1 year after trial proceedings began in the Corrie family's lawsuit against the State of Israel in March 2010. Former Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson Ruth Yaron testified primarily about the activities of the International Solidarity Movement, the organization Corrie was volunteering with at the time of her death. According to Craig Corrie, Rachel's father, Yaron's testimony was meant to discredit the ISM.
There's no justification for killing an unarmed civilian. And I think it is incredibly strange that in this court, it would allow somebody to come in with apparently all secondhand information and try to use that to justify the killing of an unarmed peace activist.
Israeli Army Commander Pinhas Suarez was scheduled to testify as another government witness yesterday, but his testimony was postponed. Zuaretz was in charge of the Gaza Division's Southern Brigade and the bulldozer units at the time of Rachel's death. He is now expected to testify in July. Gillian Kessler-Damor, FSRN, Jerusalem.
In domestic news, the Supreme Court has just ordered what is likely to be one of the largest prisoner releases in U.S. history. A 5-4 majority upheld a court order from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, directing the state of California to cut its prison population by at least 37,000 people. At issue was whether severe overcrowding in the state prison system amounted to cruel and unusual punishment, a violation of the U.S. Constitution. The majority opinion, authored by Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, said overcrowding in California prisons had already caused suffering and death, largely because of poor access to basic health care. The decision says up to 54 prisoners share one toilet in California, as many as 200 sleep in a gymnasium. The decision leaves the state with major discretion on how to reduce its prison populations. In theory, California could pay to house some prisoners in private out-of-state facilities rather than release them. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty officially entered the race for the Republican presidential nomination today. He accused President Obama of failing to tell the American people that it's not possible to fix the country's fiscal problems without making cuts.
Fluffy promises of hope and change. They don't buy our groceries, make our mortgage payments, put gas in our car, or pay for our children's school clothes or other needs.
In a poll last year, 53% of Minnesotans said they wouldn't vote for Pawlenty in a presidential race. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca. At least 89 people died after a massive tornado tore through Joplin, Missouri, Sunday. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon says a hospital was among the 2,000 buildings damaged and that the preliminary death toll may rise as rescue workers sift through the rubble. This video, recorded inside of a Joplin store by YouTube user ESLSG, gives an idea of the sheer intensity of the tornado, as well as what it was like to seek shelter with loved ones without knowing if they would survive.
We're good.
Images from the ground show a grim landscape of flattened buildings and torn up trees. In his first-person account of the storm, Joplin Globe reporter Jeff Lear wrote of walking into the street after the tornado destroyed his apartment and meeting other local residents who were unable to identify which street they were on. Lear described the scene with, quote, "There is nothing familiar left now, and you become disoriented in the unrecognizableness of your own neighborhood, your own town." When FSRN called the newsroom of the Joplin Globe today for more details, we learned that of the newspaper's 20 reporters, half had lost their homes and only three had come into work. The Joplin tornado was the worst of nearly 70 reported storms across the Midwest this past weekend. UN peacekeepers say the Sudanese border town of Abyei is burning today, with widespread looting after troops from northern Sudan entered the area. Southern Sudan is due to become independent of the North in July, and control of Abyei has been the worst sticking point in negotiations over how to divide the country. The northern forces say they entered Abyei to drive out forces loyal to the Sudan People's Liberation Army, an armed force from the country's south. Officials from South Sudan are calling the army's incursion illegal and unconstitutional. It's not clear what side of the conflict, if any, the armed looters are affiliated with. To find out more about what's happening in Abyei, UN radio reporter Derek Mabathis spoke with Koider Seruk, the spokesperson for the United Nations mission in Sudan, who's in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
What happened is that since this morning, looting and burning are ongoing in Abyei town. As a consequence to it, the Abyei residents have fled towards the south, mainly towards Agok in the south.
And how many people are fleeing to Agok from Abyei town?
We can't ascertain the exact number, but there are hundreds of thousands, actually, of civilians, including, of course, children and others and women and men, of course.
Do you have an idea of who is responsible for this looting and burning in Abyei town?
Well, who is responsible? There are civilians, armed groups. We don't know who they are in terms of whether they are organized militias or just a group of civilians taking sort of opportunity of having an empty town and looting and burning the place. We can't at this moment confirm the identity of these groups.
So you don't know whether they are from North or South Sudan either?
Well, if they are attacking southerners, I would not think that they are southerners. But they are from the north, we can't ascertain the identity at this moment of these groups.
Who is responsible for law and order in Abyei town?
Well, the responsibility rests under the SAF, which is Sudan Armed Forces, which means the government of Sudan, since they are controlling Abyei town and Abyei region. So they are responsible of maintaining security and order in town, as they have said yesterday, stating that they would provide protection to civilians. So we call on them to do so and to ensure that all civilians are protected. This is their responsibility as they are controlling the area.
As you are aware, a Security Council delegation is visiting Sudan. Is this visit having any impact on your efforts there to try to resolve the problem in Abyei?
Well, I hope this will have an impact. I know that they are meeting officials. They have met with officials here in Khartoum. They have met with tribe leaders also. And today also they are in the south. I hope the discussions will come up with a new oral reaction from the government of Sudan and also from the two parties to sort of have a final agreement which will lead to a final settlement of the Abyei issue and other outstanding issues.
That was UN radio reporter Derek Mumbatha speaking with Quader Zarok of the UN mission in Sudan. In late April, Egyptian officials announced they would permanently open the Rafah border crossing, allowing more freedom of movement for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But nearly a month later, restrictions are still in place. FSRN's Rami Al-Megari reports.
The Rafah crossing terminal in southern Gaza Strip is used by patients, students, and people with residency permits in nearby Arab countries. Before the Egyptian revolution, these people were allowed to cross through the Rafah terminal and enter Egypt. But over the last 3 months, authorities have turned many of them back.
Yes, Abu Nabil, I am turned back, brother. I am turned back. Bye.
70-year-old Saleh Zurub holds Egyptian nationality papers, but border agents have denied him entry today and each of the last 7 times he has tried to cross, saying it's because of state security.
My children are Egyptians, my grandchildren are Egyptians, my daughters are Egyptians, my brothers are Egyptians, and my father, may he rest in peace, is an Egyptian. Just look, please, at these papers, this Egyptian court ruling proving my Egyptian nationality. I want to go there to obtain my Egyptian passport. I just need 3 days to get there.
Another Gaza traveler is Mohammed al-Najjar, a 48-year-old seeking medical treatment. On Sunday, for the second time in 2 weeks, Egyptian authorities turned him away. His attempts to leave Gaza through Israel's border were also unsuccessful.
I need a surgery in my eyes in Jordan. I have a visa to Jordan and referral papers, including financial coverage from the Palestinian Authority, though I was prevented from crossing. They don't give you a clear-cut response. They only tell you that it is related to the state security apparatus, and they say you should wait until the state security personnel are back to work.
Last Thursday, Palestinian staff on the Gaza side of the terminal suspended their work for 1 day, protesting the Egyptian restrictions. Palestinian officials say that each day, Egyptian authorities deny entry to dozens of people trying to cross the border. Salama Baraka of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza is in charge of the crossing. He told the Fasaran that the Egyptian side has promised to ease those restrictions, including increasing the number of travelers allowed into Egypt each day and expanding the categories of authorized travelers, but he hasn't seen those promises put into action.
Let me please tell you that we have been maintaining a goodwill relationship with the Egyptian side at both the personal and professional levels. But unfortunately, such a relationship has not served the Palestinian citizens. We hope that the Egyptian decision makers will open the Rafah crossing terminal completely and without restrictions or conditions.
The former regime of the toppled Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak kept the Rafah crossing terminal closed for most travelers from June 2007 until January 2009, right after the Israeli war on Gaza. Since January 2009, Egyptian authorities have allowed more regular openings of the crossing, but Gazans and their supporters say Egyptian officials should make good on their promises. Rami Al-Mighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
Local elections in Spain overwhelmingly favored the right-wing political party, Partido Popular. The elections came amidst intense nationwide organizing by grassroots protesters known as the Indignados, or the Outraged. These members of the Indignados movement read aloud a manifesto detailing their reasons for camping out in public plazas across Spain. Among their list of grievances is that, quote, the political class lives in a distant reality from the citizenry, and through its economic power, it controls the system of governance. Spain has been reeling from economic woes that led to severe austerity cuts. The official unemployment rate is over 20%. As election results came in, protesters in Madrid's Plaza del Sol chanted, "They don't represent us." They plan to remain camped out in the plaza for at least another week.
First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized.
When a pro-democracy movement took to the streets of the Arab world in December and January, many of its youth participants brought their change-inspiring music with them.
Yalla. El hip-hop el masri. El agnabi.
Nigerian musician Fela Kuti said that music is the weapon of the future, and the critical lyrics and homegrown beats of Arab hip-hop played their own role in the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. FSRN plans to produce a documentary on the connection between hip-hop and the Arab uprisings, but we need your help. Visit fsrn.org to find out how you can support this project, Arab Hip-Hop, a soundtrack to the Arab Spring.
School officials in Berkeley, California, found six students with guns on or next to high school campuses during the first 4 months of 2011. This provoked a series of discussions on gun violence and a range of proposals, from installing metal detectors to adding more uniformed police on campus to requiring student ID badges. But some are emphasizing more moderate solutions and studying the root causes of the problem. Judith Scher has the story.
Student leader Ashley Webster opposes locking down the campus and requiring student IDs, and she criticizes those who say they can solve the problem of guns at school by throwing the offenders in jail.
Instead of, you know, just casting them off and expelling them, we have to realize that these students are members of our Berkeley High community, and that if they feel unsafe, there is a reason why they feel unsafe. And it's our job as the school to make them feel safe when they come here. Not to just, you know, throw these kids in jail. We have to understand that we have to somehow make them feel like they don't have to carry these guns, and that when they're here, we're going to protect them.
Berkeley is a community with stark contrasts. Better educated whites live in the hills, and less educated low-income people of color populate parts of the flatlands. There's a small continuation high school, but youth from all sectors of the community go to the 3,200-student high school, which is nationally known for its broad range of academic and arts offerings and athletic opportunities. The school provides a variety of tutoring and leadership programs, and many students take advantage of them. But Reverend Michael Smith, who works with Flatland Youth through the city's recreation department, said more is needed for young people who don't feel they're part of the system.
One could argue that the school district has either ignored or in some cases almost abandoned the downtrodden the disregarded and the dispossessed, who are the most vulnerable oftentimes of society.
Smith also questions some of the responses and wants the community to look at the deeper problems and lasting solutions.
You can talk about metal detectors all day, and you know, you can talk about everybody having, you know, uniforms and ID badges. And there are arguments on both sides. But I believe that systemic change does not really occur until you stop treating symptoms and start treating the root causes of the disease.
Smith said various agencies, including the police and probation department and the schools, need to work together to identify students at risk. Not to punish them, but to provide what Smith calls wraparound services. That could mean help for the whole family, including mental health, vocational, and academic services. But that's expensive and not likely to get funded in a state like California, facing a budget deficit of billions of dollars and threats to cut even basic education services. Devon Bogan, an expert in violence prevention, who heads the Office of Neighborhood Safety in Richmond, California, argues that while serving this population is expensive, it's less costly to help them before they get caught up in the prison system.
It's going to impact us all if we're not serious about investing in our young people. I mean, we continue to pull money out of schools and put it in other things. We say education is important, but we continue to build prisons. When you build 10 prisons, that's an investment. You expect those prisons to be filled. So you're going to do whatever it takes to ensure that you get a dividend on that investment. But we, again, are creating the conditions as adults. We're setting the policies.
The principal of Berkeley High, Pascal Scuderi, has taken the first steps to improve security without militarizing the school. But he says the community must address the question of weapons in pop culture and the ease with which a young person can get a gun.
There are some kids who are just so accustomed to having guns around, to seeing guns in popular culture, having guns play a part of every video game or every sort of piece of cinema that they experience, that I'm not sure guns seem all that out of place. There are 100 million guns on the street in this country. Do I want to eliminate every instance that a gun makes its way onto my campus? Absolutely, that's my job. And I certainly don't say this to be defensive, but I think this is something that requires a broader intervention at the community level, at the congressional level. I mean, we have got to come to terms with just how much potentially fatal hardware is on the streets in our community.
Scuderi wants to introduce curriculum to address youth who feel marginalized. Other high school staff are writing grants to fund mentors who are able to build relationships with kids who feel alienated in the school setting. Still, Reverend Smith asks if the school district has the will to change its priorities. Judith Scher, FSRN, Berkeley, California.
Building bridges between cultures is a lofty goal, but one that's not always attainable. As Jim Kent reports, Native American singers in South Dakota and their non-Native counterparts are trying to do just that through the Lakota Music Project, a cultural collaboration that brings together diverse musical genres.
It's not uncommon to hear the Porcupine Singers, a traditional Lakota drum group, throughout South Dakota. It's also not uncommon to hear the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra somewhere in the Northern Plains state. Hearing both of these sounds together, however, was pretty uncommon, until recently.
Any conductor coming into a new music directorship with an orchestra is going to spend time taking stock of the community and how the orchestra serves the community.
When Delta David Geyer took the helm of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra in 2004, his goal was to bring classical music to what he saw as traditionally underserved areas of a community. Having lived in Brooklyn, New York for 20 years, Geyer's first thought was South Dakota's African American population.
And I met this woman who was in charge of the Martin Luther King Day celebrations in Sioux Falls. And I said, you know, a lot of orchestras are involved with Martin Luther King Day, and they have concerts and invite African-American choirs and artists and so on. And when I finished talking, she said, that's really nice if you want to pursue that, but I got to tell you, I'm a black woman, and I don't have a problem in South Dakota. If you want to talk about racial prejudice here, you got to talk about Native Americans.
Geyer followed the woman's advice and contacted Barry LeBeau, a Lakota who works with Native American artists across the state. LeBeau told Geyer that portions of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra had already been sent to various reservations over the years for educational purposes, but Geyer had bigger plans. So LeBeau put him in touch with Ronnie Theis, Professor Emeritus of American Indian Studies at Black Hills State University. Although he's non-native, Theis has sung with the Porcupine Singers, based on the Pine Ridge Reservation, since 1972. He's now their oldest and most experienced member. The Porcupine Singers date back to pre-reservation times. They're known across the country for keeping the traditional songs of the Lakota alive and have sung at the Kennedy Center, as well as performing for the film Dances with Wolves. Ronnie Theis says some thought went into Geyer's offer to collaborate with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra.
For traditional singers, the compelling value is always to preserve the tradition, not to experiment too much, not to change things to make it like Anglo music.
Since Geyer's Lakota Music Project would combine aspects of both classical and traditional Lakota music, Theis and the Porcupine Singers felt it could work. As performed during their recent appearance at Crazy Horse Mountain in South Dakota's Black Hills, the first part of the program offers individual selections by both groups on the human conditions of love, war, death, and joy. During the second half of the program, the groups collaborate, as shown in the joint composition, Desert Wind, Harmony Song. Both native and non-native musicians say they enjoyed the collaboration. Violinist Magdalena Modzelewska is from Poland. She's played with the orchestra since 1998, but sees this project as an incredible musical and cultural journey.
You feel the greatness of the moment, the importance of it, and it's wonderful, it really is wonderful.
Emmanuel Blackbear agrees.
We sing a lot of old songs, and so does the orchestra. They have music dating back into the 1600s that they play too. So it's not just anything, you know. A lot of thoughts gone into these songs and what we're doing, and it's for our music, you know. No matter what race you are, it's the music.
The Lakota Music Project has been bringing cultures together and educating its audiences about traditional Lakota music since May 2009. But Delta David Geyer notes that the music doesn't stop once the show has ended. Another piece has already been commissioned for future performances, so the project can continue to expand its unique sound. Jim Kent, FSRN, Custer, South Dakota.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katopshi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us at comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young.